You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Violent crime has been on a downward trend nationwide since the 1990s, but it's still a big issue facing some of the nation's major cities and raising questions about the best ways police departments can prevent that violent crime. For decades, one of the more common methods departments have used is low-level enforcement, also known as broken windows policing, that focuses on punishing smaller crimes to prevent further disorder. Our next guest says the data shows this approach misunderstands the real nature of urban crime. He says taking a closer look at who commits violent crime and why should bring us to a new way of policing areas that are considered the most violent. Stephen Lurie is a writer and former researcher for the National Network for Safe Communities. His recent piece for City Lab is under the headline, "There's No Such Thing as a Dangerous Neighborhood." Stephen, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with this concept of broken windows policing. When it came out, what was the theory? What was the idea behind it?
Sure. So originally, the idea of a broken windows theory is the concept that if you have broken windows in a given neighborhood, in a given area, that this is a signal to people, to signal to other people in the area that this is a lawless area. And that through this signal that there's a broken window and no one is fixing it, it will encourage people who see that signal to commit further crimes, to be able to be confident in the idea that they too will not get caught in doing things such as property destruction or breaking into a house or breaking into a car. And the theory originally went on to say that this is a chain that continues until you encourage criminality in a way that can lead to even more serious crime, including violence.
How did that translate into police procedure?
Sure. So if you are convinced by this theory, naturally you would think, well, if we know that there are going to be criminals or people who commit criminal activity that will start at a low level but eventually lead to violence, your theory of change might be to try to prevent violence by starting at the source, by cracking down on those initial thoughts, those initial opportunities that one perceives as an opportunity for criminal activity. So if you're a police department, and many police departments did do this, your response is going to be to arrest people for low-level infractions, to question them on the street for suspicious activity, to stop and frisk them for potential drugs or contraband. And in that way, the theory goes, you're going to ultimately prevent violence. What we know now is that that's simply not how it works.
Right. Looking back at the data, looking at the places that did and didn't adopt this broken windows, this low-level enforcement process, what have we learned about whether or not it works?
Well, the evidence quite overwhelmingly is that there's no real connection between cracking down on low-level offenses and preventing violent crime. And the reason is that those two chains are not linked. The fact is that people who are committing low-level infractions, which in reality is pretty much everyone, from those who drink underage to those who speed and break the law, are not the same people or are not exclusively the same people as those who commit violence. And the people who do commit violence are doing so in particular reasons, for particular reasons, due to particular motivations. And the preponderance of evidence, in fact, shows us that when you try to enforce upon those low-level infractions as a way of preventing violence, you're actually more likely to alienate the communities that you're trying to serve by intruding upon their personal life, by intruding upon their community life in a way that can be disruptive, that can be violent, and that can break down the trust that one would need to actually prevent violence in situations where that sort of enforcement is called for.
Talking to Stephen Lurie, writer, former researcher for the National Network for Safe Communities, talking about a piece he wrote for City Lab about broken windows policing, who commits violent crime, and what might work best to prevent that crime. And Stephen, a lot of the heart of your piece is in what you were just talking about, looking at who is committing violent crime in a community. What do we know?
Well, let me first start by saying that there are multiple types of violence in a community and in any place. You will have private violence in the home, intimate partner violence, and you'll have community violence out in the public sphere. And what I talk about in the article and in my research is particularly about the problem of community violence And what we look at is the data from a bunch of cities over a bunch of years, over 20 cities over 20 years. And we're looking at the fact that when we count up the total number of homicides in a given city, when we count up the total number of shootings, what we find is that nearly 50%, around 50% of those homicides or shootings is connected to a very, very, very small percentage of any given city. And that very, very small percentage, usually about a half of one percentage point, are the people, usually young men in disadvantaged communities, young men of color, who are connected to what we refer to as street groups, what other people might refer to as gangs, sets, crews, or posses. And that there's an intense, intense concentration of the serious violence in our cities among these groups that really tells us that if we're going to try and prevent violence in a serious way, if we want to try and prevent what constitutes nearly half of all homicides and shootings in many American cities, we should be focusing our resources on those young men who are both vulnerable to being victimized themselves and vulnerable to picking up a gun and committing violence themselves.
And there's a horrible irony there for members of these gangs or whatever we want to call them, that because they might not feel like the authorities make them safe, they've lost trust in police, for example, they feel like they might need to join a gang for their own safety, for their own protection, which then makes them far more likely to commit or be on the receiving end of a crime.
That's exactly right. And what we can call that is a protection paradox, right? The idea that you join a gang, you join together with other people for protection in the hopes that it will make you safer. But in reality, what we find is that it actually identifies you as someone who is more likely to be in conflict, who's more likely to be around weapons that can lead to dangerous situations, and more likely to use violence as a way to settle disputes because you don't trust in the official authorities to be there for you to solve the disputes that you need solved.
If you were trying to craft a police policy targeting that, preventing that, as you say, about 50% of homicides in a community done by a half a percent of the population of that community, what would that kind of policing look like?
So the first thing that I would note is that that sort of policing has to be in tandem, in conjunction with the communities where this violence is occurring. It has to be in conjunction with social service and support agencies who serve those communities. That the policing function has to be part of an effort to boost the fact that these communities, from the beginning, are already overwhelmingly resilient and overwhelmingly able to prevent violence themselves. And so what you'd look for is the type of policing that we've seen in many strategies that sometimes go by the name of focused deterrence strategies or group violence interventions that are going to pair the capacities of law enforcement with community organizations, with social service support agencies to focus attention on that really small population and to be able to get them support that they need, the protection that they need, and get them connected to the community voices that are there trying to prevent the violence already.
We're talking to Stephen Lurie right now about research into the dynamics of urban violence, the history of broken window policing, and thinking about crime as a product of small, in effect, social networks. A lot of violent crime committed by a very small set of people within a community. What should a police response look like? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your reactions to the ideas our guest is bringing up? If you live or have lived somewhere people have called a violent neighborhood, what did that look like to you? What did it look like to live in it? What was policing like there? If you're in law enforcement yourself, what have you seen that works or doesn't work when it comes to violence prevention in the communities you work in? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Stephen Lurie, a writer and former researcher for the National Network for Safe Communities, looking at the concentration of violent urban crime to a small number of residents and what that might mean for policing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions or ideas, reactions to the history of what's been called broken windows policing around the United States. If you live or have lived somewhere that people see as a violent or dangerous community, what do you want people to know about where you live? What do you think police can do to try to deal with crime? And what do you think communities, with or without the police, in efforts can do to try to prevent crime? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. In your piece in City Lab, Stephen, you also talk about really targeted efforts looking at the people who are prone to or who have joined gangs or similar organizations. What kind of targeted approaches are there to, I guess, get them back out and prevent them from getting involved in the violence that can come along with it?
Sure. It's a great question. And one of the distinctions that I think is really important to start with is that just because someone is in a group or is in a gang does not mean they're going to commit a homicide or commit a shooting. In reality, even within that very small population that we're discussing here, that 0.5%, 0.5 of 1%, only a very, very small number of people within that population, within that group population, is actually going to be committing or going to be victimized by violence. That said, what we do know is that by focusing on the people in those groups, by trying to promote pro-social norms within the groups themselves, we can help reduce violence before it starts. Now, that can look like a couple things. That can look like connecting the individuals within those groups with the type of counseling and support that they need. It can mean looking to support them in very small ways that may reduce the friction or reduce the friction that they face or their vulnerability to being victimized. It can look like providing bus passes. It can look like cognitive behavioral therapy. But it can also look like providing connections between often those young people and the people who are already in those communities, people who may have been involved in gangs in the past, people who may be community leaders, who do authentically care for those young people, who do care for them to be alive and out of prison, and help to support and bolster those sorts of connections within the community and get the message to them clearly that the violence needs to stop and that they need to be part of the community as well. The whole shift here is about understanding that there really are a small number of people that we can be focusing our resources on instead of deploying law enforcement as a sole response to a whole community.
And in your piece, you write that with the broken windows style of policing, we may do very well at arresting people for a lot of lesser crimes. That doesn't necessarily translate into doing things like solving homicides.
Exactly. It's, in fact, a completely different type of law enforcement. And what we do find in many communities that are considered by some to be dangerous, but what we will refer to as communities that face high levels of violence, is what really matters to people is the fact that there is often no justice and no accountability for those very serious forms of crime, for those shootings, for those homicides. And if you're not investing enough energy and resources and capacity in trying to solve those fundamental problems, then it doesn't matter if you're going to arrest people for drinking on the stoop or for having marijuana, because that's not the type of issue that's going to get the community to trust that you're there to protect them from the things that matter most.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Eric is calling from Chicago. Eric, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I was just kind of curious on the gentleman's thoughts with family law. We've been very aware of the statistics and the situations he speaks of, but sadly, we've been bringing this to so many different entities, from the far left to the right and everyone in between. But family law, when we know that approximately 90% of those cases that you're speaking of are directly related to fatherless homes and situations where the very government and or the law enforcement communities are responsible for taking children away from parents and so on, why aren't we addressing it from that approach if we know that that accounts for, like I say, 80 to 90%, depending on, major crime, thefts, rapes, murders, and so on.
Eric, thanks a lot for the call. So Stephen concerns about, and people have raised this issue, concerns about lack of sufficient family, adult supervision for kids. Also concerns about if a lot of the males in a community are in prison, they're obviously absent from parenting in that situation, too.
Sure. So I think an important point to start with here is that this might be an issue of correlation, but not causation, right? That I wouldn't dispute the caller's facts, perhaps, about a correlation between fatherless homes and those who commit violence. But it's clear that that's not what the cause is, right? Because we know that there are, in fact, far more people who live in fatherless homes than people who commit violence. That this is not, in fact, a causal mechanism, that what we really need to look at, and this is what the evidence shows us year after year, decade after decade, is that violence in these communities is a product of the distrust and underprotection that there's been in those communities for decades. And that that distrust of law enforcement, the distrust of, and often very justified distrust of, the state institutions that are meant to support and protect people, that that's what the basis of this violence really is. And so there may be questions about family, home life that should be addressed perhaps through other means, through community organizations, through social supports, but it's not, to us and to the data, a question of violence.
Thanks for the call, Eric, at 800-642-1234. We're talking about violent crime and policing with Stephen Lurie, writer, former researcher for the National Network for Safe Communities. He wrote a piece on the topic in CityLab. Stephen, can you point to a any communities around the country you think who are doing some of the things you're talking about and getting positive results from it?
Sure. So there are actually quite a few. I don't want to say success stories, because whenever you have high levels of violence in a given city, whenever you have one homicide, it's too many. But you could look at a couple cities from the smaller ones up northeast, such as Newburgh, New York, to more of a mid-sized, larger city over in Oakland, California, that have been using a really focused approach to these small groups of people in order to prevent violence. And both cities have been deploying, in conjunction, law enforcement capacity, social service capacity, community capacity, to really focus on these groups, people who are in these groups, communicate to them, support them where possible, protect them when they can, and use law enforcement when necessary. And both examples have had really significant reductions in their homicides and shootings over the last few years.
Stephen, the things you're talking about there are nuanced. They're hard to explain quickly in some ways. It's easy for maybe politicians in particular to do things that we could describe as tough on crime, cracking down on crime. Does that make it an uphill battle to propose these ideas?
You know, I think that it has in the past. And I think that it's been difficult, because there is some sort of intuitive charm to the idea that when we're tough, we're going to get results. But I think at this point, the tide has really turned in terms of the understanding that a decade, two decades, three decades of a failed approach of broken windows hasn't made communities safer. And what we're excited about with our research, and what we're excited about with others' research over the last 10 and 20 years, is that we've seen that when you do focus on the small numbers of people, that can also be intuitive, because communities already know this. Right? If we're listening to the communities where the violence is the highest, they are the ones that have known and know still that it's not an entire neighborhood that's dangerous. It's that there are people who need support. There are people who need to be focused on, who need, in some cases, attention from law enforcement. And that, I think now we're seeing the tide turning, and that can also be an intuitive idea if we're listening to the facts and listening to the people who live in those communities themselves.
Now, if we have a community where violent crime rates are high, disproportionately high compared to even other comparable communities around the country, I guess I'll throw out an example of a place like Baltimore right now, and there is that lack of trust between communities and the police department. How do you start? What is step one to get from where they are now to what you're talking about?
It's a difficult question, certainly. And I think this is where the field of sort of criminology and criminal justice really has to mix with that of conflict resolution and sociology and psychology and history. And I think that one of the first steps that's necessary whenever you're going to engage and try to turn the page on a past chapter is a recognition that there's been failure. And I think where we've seen the most success is when we've seen cities recognize publicly to their community that there's been a failure to protect and to serve and to support the communities that face the highest levels of violence. And in doing so, they gain a little bit of trust in being on the same page, in reconciling their vantage point with the community's vantage point about where they've been. And in doing so, can start to work together on where they should go next.
Is there a requirement, I guess, that there's community engagement, that this isn't a top-down approach, that as you're coming up with these solutions, community stakeholders are at the table from day one?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's part of the history that we've seen, is that when you try and use repressive policing, repressive tactics, these are things that are coming from the top, that are coming often from external sources and aren't what the community asks for or isn't the way that the community is asking for law enforcement support. And the fact is that the vast majority of violence is going to be prevented because the community is able to prevent it with the support of those who are working on violence reduction efforts. And so if you want to be effective, the places where we've seen the most effective violence reduction is where the community is on board and as a major stakeholder in doing the work.
Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Stephen Lurie, writer and former researcher for the National Network for Safe Communities. He was with us to talk about violent crime and policing. He says law enforcement needs to move beyond the broken windows school of policing. Coming up, we'll talk about the college admissions bribery scandal that's been dominating the news the last couple of days and wider concerns about bias and inequality when it comes to higher education. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.